In the tantric texts of medieval and modern India, the abode of the goddess is called Manidvipa, the island of jewels. Her couch and throne is there, in a grove of wish-fulfilling trees. The beaches of the isle are of golden sands. They are laved by the still waters of the ocean of the nectar of immortality. The goddess is red with the fire of life. The earth, the solar system, the galaxies of far-extending space all swell within her womb, for she is the world creatrix, ever mother, ever virgin. She encompasses the encompassing, nourishes the nourishing, and is the life of everything that lives. She is also the death of everything that dies. The whole round of existence is accomplished within her sway, from birth through adolescence, maturity, and senescence to the grave. She is the womb, she is the tomb, the sow that eats her farrow. Thus she unites the good and the bad, exhibiting the two modes of the remembered mother, not as personal only, but as universal. The devotee is expected to contemplate the two with equal equanimity. Through this exercise, his spirit is purged of its infantile, inappropriate sentimentalities and resentments, and his mind opened to the inscrutable presence which exists not primarily as good and bad, but as the law and image of the nature of being. Woman, in the picture language of mythology, represents the totality of what can be known. The hero is the one who comes to know. As he progresses in the slow initiation which is life, the form of the goddess undergoes for him a series of transfigurations. She can never be greater than himself, though she can always promise more than he is yet capable of comprehending. She lures, she guides, she bids him burst his fetters. And if he can match her import, the two, the knower and the known, will be released from every limitation. Woman is the guide to the sublime acne of sensuous adventure. By deficient eyes, she is reduced to inferior states. By the evil eye of ignorance, she is spellbound to banality and ugliness. But she is redeemed by the eyes of understanding. The hero who can take her as she is, without undue commotion, but with the kindness and assurance she requires, is potentially the king, the incarnate god of her created world. The meeting with the goddess, who is incarnate in every woman, is the final test of the talent of the hero to win the boon of love, which is life itself, enjoyed as the encasement of eternity. And when the adventurer in this context is not a youth, but a maid, she is the one who, by her qualities, her beauty, or her yearning, is fit to become the consort of an immortal. Then the heavenly husband descends to her and conducts her to his bed, whether she will or no. And if she has shunned him, the scales fall from her eyes. If she has sought him, her desire finds its peace. The king's daughter of the Frog Prince tale, on the day following the adventure at the well, heard a thumping at her castle door.
So she's sitting at table with Daddy, King Daddy, and Queen Mother, and a little princess in the middle. And they're doing very well with their golden plates and all, when up the front steps comes plop, 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 and she goes white. Bang on the door. Daddy says, "What's that? You seem disturbed." I says, "Just a little frog I met." And Daddy says, Daddy represents the principles and demands of the world of society and virtue and all that. And Daddy says, "Make any promises?" She says, "Well, yes." Well, he says, "Let him in." So in comes this candidate, and he's on the floor. He says, "I want to sit at the table with you." So she puts him there, and I spoils that meal. So she goes upstairs, and he's up there after her, and she says, "You could stay down there." He says, "I want in. I want in the bed." Now, the story has two or three versions at this point. The one that I like is the one where she picks the frog up and simply hurls him at the wall. And when that happens to a frog, it's not normally good for him. But in this case, it splits in half, and there stands this beautiful prince with eyelashes like a camel. And the girl is enchanted. And the story says, and so they were married, and she introduced him next morning to Daddy. This is known in Sanskrit as a Gandharva marriage, a marriage of angels. No sooner is he introduced to Daddy than there is heard out under the porte cochere a coach drawing up, and it's the coach of the prince's land. Well, how come that this prince had become a frog? Anyone who's read his Freud knows why. He had been bewitched by a witch, who, as we know, is always mother. This is what had thrown him out down into the bottom of the well, and there he was as a frog now. And he finds his princess, his soul girl. He has gone down, so has she. This is where their divine marriage took place. And now there is revived the land. The coach comes to fetch them home. Now they've got an easy journey back. They're riding along the coach. It's being driven by a coachman whose name is Iron Henry. And they're going fine when they hear bang. And the prince says, "What's the matter, Henry? Do we break a spring?" No, says Henry, nothing of the kind. "Ever since your departure, there have been four iron bands around my heart." This is the wasteland motif, the drowned man motif that Eliot speaks of in the wasteland. So bang, 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 there are three more bangs, and that means that the restricting, killing thing has been broken, and the elixir is simply the return of this fulfilled youth. It's an optimistic story, and I like it particularly because it has both ends. The girl's quest and the boy's quest are both brought together here. He has been thrown out. She has lost her own joy in life, and it's from the bottom of the well that their redemption comes.
Woman as the temptress. The mystical marriage with the queen goddess of the world represents the hero's total mastery of life. For the woman is life, the hero its knower and master. And the testings of the hero were symbolical of those crises of realization by which his consciousness came to be made capable of enduring the full possession of the mother destroyer, his inevitable bride. With what he knows that he and the father are one, he is in the father's place. Phrased in this way, the problem may sound remote from the affairs of normal human creatures. Nevertheless, every failure to cope with a life situation must be laid, in the end, to a restriction of consciousness. Wars and temper tantrums are the makeshifts of ignorance. Regrets are illuminations come too late. The whole sense of the myth of the hero's passage is that it shall serve as a general pattern for men and women wherever they may stand along the scale. The individual has only to discover his own position with reference to this general human formula, and let it then assist him past his restricting walls. Who and where are his ogres? Those are the reflections of the unsolved enigmas of his own humanity. What are his ideals? Those are the symptoms of his grasp of life. In the office of the modern psychoanalyst, the stages of the hero adventure come to light again in the dreams and hallucinations of the patient. Depth beyond depth of self-ignorance is fathomed, with the analyst in the role of the helper, the initiatory priest. And always, after the first thrills of getting underway, the adventure develops into a journey of disgust and phantasmagoric fears. The crux of the curious difficulty lies in the fact that our conscious views of what life ought to be seldom correspond to what life really is. Generally, we refuse to admit within ourselves or within our friends the fullness of that pushing, self-protective, malodorous, carnivorous, lecherous fever which is the very nature of the organic cell. Rather, we tend to perfume, whitewash, and reinterpret, meanwhile imagining that all the flies in the ointment, all the hairs in the soup, are the faults of some unpleasant someone else. But when it suddenly dawns on us, or is forced to our attention, that everything we think or do is necessarily tainted with the odor of the flesh, there is a moment of revulsion. Life, the acts of life, the organs of life, woman in particular as the great symbol of life, become intolerable to the pure, pure soul. The innocent delight of Oedipus in his first possession of the queen turns to an agony of spirit when he learns who the woman is. Like Hamlet, he is beset by the moral image of the father. Like Hamlet, he turns from the fair features of the world to search the darkness for a higher kingdom than this of the incest and adultery-ridden, luxurious and incorrigible mother. The seeker of the life beyond life must press beyond her, surpass the temptations of her call, and soar to the immaculate ether beyond. Where this Oedipus-Hamlet revulsion remains to beset the soul, there the world, the body, and woman above all, become the symbols no longer of victory, but of defeat. A monastic, puritanical, world-negating ethical system then radically and immediately transfigures all the images of myth. No longer can the hero rest in innocence with the goddess of the flesh, for she has become the queen of sin. Atonement with the Father.
The second kind of crisis is that of father at one-ment, atonement. Now this can be depicted as atonement, as it is in the biblical tradition where we are atoned with the Father, or as at one-ment, when Christ says, I and the Father are one. The word atonement actually is made up of these two, and it has these two different meanings. This is the way in patriarchal mythologies, in which case very often the last test and temptation is that of a sexual temptation. The temptation of sex as the final temptation to be transcended, the ascetic tradition. These are the ways of the mythologies that we're most familiar with.
The bow of God's wrath is bent, and the arrow made ready on the string, and justice bends the arrow at your heart and strains the bow, and it is nothing but the mere pleasure of God, and that of an angry God, without any promise or obligation at all, that keeps the arrow one moment from being made drunk with your blood. With these words, Jonathan Edwards threatened his New England congregation by disclosing to them, unmitigated, the ogre aspect of the Father. The ogre aspect of the Father is a reflex of the victim's own ego, derived from the nursery, the fixating idolatry that is itself the fault that keeps one steeped in a sense of sin, sealing the potentially adult spirit from a better balanced, more realistic view of the Father and therewith of the world. Atonement, at one-ment, consists in no more than the abandonment of that self-generated double monster, the dragon thought to be God, the superego, and the dragon thought to be sin, repressed id. But this requires an abandonment of the attachment to ego itself, and that is what's difficult. One must have a faith that the Father is merciful, and then a reliance on that mercy. Therewith, the center of belief is transferred outside of the bedeviling God's tight, scaly ring, and the dreadful ogres dissolve. It is in this ordeal that the hero may derive hope and assurance from the helpful female figure by whose magic he is protected through all the frightening experiences of the Father's ego-shattering initiation. With that reliance for support, one endures the crisis, only to find in the end that the Father and the Mother reflect each other and are, in essence, the same. When the twin warriors of the Navajo, having departed from Spider Woman with her advice and protective charms, had made their perilous way between the rocks that crush, through the reeds that cut to pieces, and the cactus plants that tear to pieces, and then across the boiling sands, they came at last to the house of the sun, their father. The door was guarded by two bears. These arose and growled, but the words that Spider Woman had taught the boys made the animals crouch down again. After the bears, there threatened a pair of serpents, then winds, then lightnings, the guardians of the ultimate threshold. All were readily appeased, however, with the words of the prayer. Built of turquoise, the house of the sun was great and square, and it stood on the shore of a mighty water. The boys entered it, and they beheld a woman sitting in the west, two handsome young men in the south, two handsome young women in the north. The young woman stood up without a word, wrapped the newcomers in four sky coverings, and placed them on a shelf. The boys lay quietly. Presently, a rattle hanging over the door shook four times, and one of the young women said, "Our father is coming." The bearer of the sun strode into his home, removed the sun from his back, and hung it on a peg on the west wall of the room, where it shook and clanged for some time, going, "Tla, tla, tla, tla." He returned to the older woman and demanded angrily, "Who were those two that entered here today?" But the woman did not reply. The young people looked at one another. The bearer of the sun put his question angrily 4 times before the woman said to him at last, "It would be well for you not to say too much. 2 young men came hither today seeking their father. You have told me that you pay no visits when you go abroad and that you have met no woman but me. Whose sons then are these?" She pointed to the bundle on the shelf, and the children smiled significantly at one another. The bearer of the sun took the bundle from the shelf, unrolled the 4 robes, the robes of dawn, blue sky, yellow evening light, and darkness, and the boys fell out on the floor. He immediately seized them. Fiercely he flung them at some great sharp spikes of white shell that stood in the east. The boys tightly clutched their life feathers and bounded back. The man hurled them equally hard at the spikes of turquoise in the south, Haliotis in the west, and black rock in the north. The boys always clutched their life feathers lightly and came bounding back. "I wish it were indeed true," said the son, "that they were my children." The terrible father then tried to steam the boys to death in an overheated sweat lodge. They were aided by the winds, who provided a protected retreat within the lodge in which to hide. "Yes, these are my children," said the son when they emerged. But that was only a ruse, for he was still planning to trick them. The final ordeal was a smoking pipe filled with poison. A spiny caterpillar warned the boys and gave them something to put into their mouths. They smoked the pipe without harm, passing it back and forth to one another till it was finished. They even said then it tasted sweet. The son was proud. He was completely satisfied. "Now, my children," he asked, "what is it you want from me? Why do you seek me?" The twin heroes had won the full confidence of the son, their father. When the child outgrows the popular idol of the mother breast and turns to face the world of specialized adult action, it passes spiritually into the sphere of the father, who becomes, for his son, the sign of the future task, and for his daughter, the sign of the future husband. Whether he knows it or not, and no matter what his position in society, the father is the initiating priest through whom the young being passes on into the larger world. And just as formerly the mother represented the good and evil, so now does he, but with this complication, that there is a new element of rivalry in the picture, the son against the father for the mastery of the universe, and the daughter against the mother to be the mastered world. The traditional idea of initiation combines an introduction of the candidate into the duties and privileges of his vocation and into a radical readjustment of his emotional relationship to the parental images. The mystagogue, father or father substitute, is to entrust the symbols of office only to a son who has been purged of all inappropriate infantile cathexes and for whom the exercise of such powers will not be rendered impossible by unconscious motives of self-aggrandizement or resentment. Ideally, the invested one has been divested of his mere humanity and is representative of an impersonal cosmic force. He is the twice-born. He has become himself, the father, and he is competent, consequently, now to enact himself the role of the initiator, the guide, the sundor, through whom one may pass from the infantile illusions of good and evil to an experience of the mystery of cosmic law, purged of hope and fear, and at peace in the understanding of the revelation of being. The paradox of creation, the coming of the forms of time out of eternity, is the germinal secret of the Father. It can never be quite explained. Therefore, in every system of theology, there is an umbilical point, an Achilles tendon, which the finger of mother life has touched, and where the possibility of perfect knowledge has been impaired. The problem of the hero is to pierce himself and therewith his world precisely through that point, to shatter and annihilate that key knot of his limited existence. The problem of the hero going to meet the Father is to open his soul beyond terror to such a degree that he will be ripe to understand how the insane tragedies of this ruthless cosmos are completely validated in the majesty of being. The hero transcends life with its peculiar blind spot and for a moment rises to a glimpse of the source. He beholds the face of the Father, understands, and the two are atoned. In the biblical story of Job, the Lord makes no attempt to justify in human or any other terms the ill pay meted out to his virtuous servant.
God behaved like a monster to Job. This was a perfectly ruthless, atrocious job. His friend the devil comes and says, you think Job is a good man and respects you. That's because you've been good to him, but you treat him badly and watch. God says, I'll bet, and it was on. And then they started to work on this poor man, and you know what happened. House gone, family gone, everything gone, health gone. He ends up on a pile of ashes with a case of bad boils and so forth. And his friends come to him and say, Job, you must really have been bad to be punished this way. And he said, nothing of the kind. I haven't. And he was right. And the point was, he was punished not because he was bad, but because he was good. And finally, his insistence on the fact that he had not misbehaved brought God himself to show himself. And what did God say? Did he say, look here, you've been great, Job. I had this bet and I've won. No, he didn't say that. Nor did he try by any roundabout rationalization to explain this thing in decent terms. It was an indecent act. He simply said, are you big? Could you fill Leviathan's nose with harpoons? I did. Try it. See how you can do. Who are you, you little worm, to address yourself to the problem of what I'm doing? And Job abdicates his human judgment and says, O Lord, who is man that thou shouldst regard him? I have heard of thee with mine ears. I behold thee with mine eyes. I put ashes on my head. I'm ashamed. That is the submission of the human judgment to the divine mystery.
There is no word of explanation, no mention of the dubious wager with Satan described in chapter 1 of the book of Job, only a thunder and lightning demonstration of the fact of facts, namely that man cannot measure the will of God, which derives from a center beyond the range of human categories. Nevertheless, to Job himself, the revelation appears to have made soul-satisfying sense. He was a hero who, by his courage in the fiery furnace, his unreadiness to break down and grovel before a popular conception of the character of the All-Highest, had proven himself capable of facing a greater revelation than the one that satisfied his friends. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. The pious comforters are humbled. Job is rewarded with a fresh house, fresh servants, and fresh daughters and sons. After this lived Job 140 years, and saw his sons and his sons' sons, even 4 generations. So Job died, being old and full of days. For the son who has really grown to know the Father, the agonies of the ordeal are readily borne. The world is no longer a veil of tears, but a bliss-yielding, perpetual manifestation of the Presence. Apotheosis.
The third way
is what I call apotheosis, where the hero realizes that he is the divine being himself. This is the way of the Buddha, who becomes the Buddha. He isn't atoned with any father. He isn't united with any goddess.
He realizes, Tathamasi, thou art that, I am that. That is full realization. These are the 3 high modes of realization symbolized in the high religions.
One of the most powerful and beloved of the bodhisattvas of the Mahayana Buddhism of Tibet, China, and Japan is the lotus bearer, the Lord looking down in pity, so called because he regards with compassion all sentient creatures suffering the evils of existence. To him goes the million-fold repeated prayer of the prayer wheels and the temple gongs of Tibet. Om Mani Padme Hum, the jewel is in the lotus. To him go perhaps more prayers per minute than to any single divinity known to man. For when, during his final life on earth as a human being, he shattered the bounds of the last threshold, he paused. He made a vow that before entering the void, he would bring all creatures without exception to enlightenment, so that the least prayer addressed to him throughout the vast spiritual empire of the Buddha is graciously heard. He reveals himself in human form with 2 arms, in superhuman forms with 4 arms, or with 6, or 12, or 1,000, and he holds in one of his left hands the lotus of the world. Like the Buddha himself, This godlike being is a pattern of the divine state to which the human hero attains who has gone beyond the last terrors of ignorance. As the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra states, when the envelopment of consciousness has been annihilated, then he becomes free of all fear, beyond the reach of change. This is the release potential within us all, and which anyone can attain through herohood. For as we read, all things are Buddha things, or again, and this is the other way of making the same statement, all beings are without self. In China and Japan, this sublimely gentle bodhisattva is represented not only in male form, but also as female. Kuan Yin of China, Kuan On of Japan, the Madonna of the Far East, is precisely this benevolent regarder of the world. She will be found in every Buddhist temple of the farthest Orient. She is blessed alike to the simple and to the wise, for behind her vow there lies a profound intuition, world-redeeming, world-sustaining. The first wonder to be noted here is the androgynous character of the bodhisattva. Male-female gods are not uncommon in the world of myth. They emerge always with a certain mystery, for they conduct the mind beyond objective experience into a symbolic realm where duality is left behind. Awona Wilona, chief guide of the Pueblo of Zuni, the maker and container of all, is sometimes spoken of as he, but is actually he-she. The great original of the Chinese chronicles, the holy woman Tai Yuan, combined in her person the masculine yang and the feminine yin. The Kabbalistic teachings of the medieval Jews, as well as the Gnostic teachings of Christianity in the second century, represent the Word made flesh as androgynous, which was indeed the state of Adam as he was created before the female aspect, Eve, was removed into another form. And among the Greeks, not only Hermaphrodite, the child of Hermes and Aphrodite, but Eros too, the divinity of love, the first of the gods, according to Plato, were in sex both female and male. The bisexual god is the mystery of the theme of initiation. We are taken from the mother, chewed into fragments, and assimilated to the world-annihilating body of the ogre for whom all the precious forms and beings are only the courses of a feast. But then, miraculously reborn, we are more than we were. If the god is a tribal, racial, national, or sectarian archetype, we are the warriors of his cause. But if he is a lord of the universe itself, we then go forth as knowers to whom all men are brothers. And in either case, the childhood parent images and ideas of good and evil have been surpassed. We no longer desire and fear. We are what was desired and feared. This is the sense of the first wonder of the bodhisattva, the androgynous character of the presence. Therewith, the two apparently opposite mythological adventures come together, the meeting with the goddess and the atonement with the father. For in the first, the initiate learns that male and female are two halves of a split pea, where in the second, the father is found to be antecedent to the division of sex. The pronoun he was a manner of speech, the myth of sonship a guiding line to be erased. And in both cases it is found, or rather recollected, that the hero himself is that which he had come to find. The second wonder to be noted in the bodhisattva myth is its annihilation of the distinction between life and release from life, which is symbolized in the bodhisattva's renunciation of nirvana. Briefly, nirvana means the extinguishing of the threefold fire of desire, hostility, and delusion. In the legend of the temptation under the Bo tree, the antagonist of the future Buddha was Kama Mara, literally desire, hostility, or love and death, the magician of delusion. He was a personification of the threefold fire and of the difficulties of the last test, a final threshold guardian to be passed by the universal hero on his supreme adventure to nirvana. Having subdued within himself the threefold fire, which is the moving power of the universe, the Savior beheld reflected as in a mirror all around him the last projected fantasies of his primitive physical will to live like other human beings, the will to live according to the normal motives of desire and hostility. And this was the moment on which all depended, for from one coal could arise again the whole conflagration.
Now, the legend with respect to Bodhisattva is that as he was about to deliquesce, you know, in the last rapture of nirvanic realization and no longer return to the world in the round of rebirths, He heard the clouds and trees and rocks and all send up a cry of lament. And he asked, why this? And the cry was then explained. They said that your presence here has given us a realization of the imminence of nirvana, and your departure will deprive us of this. And so he resolved to remain in the world, to keep coming back, not to leave, but to represent the imminence of nirvana in the world. Now that's the meaning of that Tibetan saying, Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme means the jewel is in the lotus. The jewel of nirvanic realization, that is to say, the dimension of mystery, the dimension of consubstantiality, the dimension of illumination, is right imminent here. This is the golden lotus world, whether you see it as such or not. In its horror, in its banality, in its cruelty, in its lust, this is the nirvanic world. And it's not to be corrected. It can't be corrected. What is to be corrected is your optical dress. So unless you can see that, you will not realize that it's operative here. Now, this one whose being is illumination. Bodhi means illumination, sattva means being. He whose being sattva is illumination remains in the world. And the notion is that he operates through us in our consorting with each other. Whether we are intentionally striving to illuminate each other or not, we are doing so all the time. And this is the operation of Avalokiteshvara's compassion, karuna, in the world. He is depicted always with a kingly crown, as each of us is depicted, so to say, with the signs of our function in society, our role in society, and through our functioning that way, we are incarnations of that principle of Avalokiteshvara, each in his own dimension. So this idea of the mysticism that is that of the person in the world, doing his duty in the world, not thinking of himself with a kind of longer neck and higher locus, but just humbly and simply doing his work, that is a mystical work also. And it's the mystical way of the Bodhisattva.
This greatly celebrated legend affords an excellent example of the close relationship maintained in the Orient between myth, psychology, and metaphysics. There is a certain resemblance of this ancient mythological doctrine of the dynamics of the psyche to the teachings of the modern Freudian school. According to the latter, the life wish, eros or libido, corresponding to the Buddhist kama, desire, and the death wish, thanatos or destrudo, which is identical with the Buddhist mara, or hostility or death, are the two drives that not only move the individual from within, but also animate for him the surrounding world. Moreover, the unconsciously grounded delusions from which desires and hostilities arise are in both systems dispelled by psychological analysis and illumination. Yet the aims of the two teachings, the traditional and the modern, are not exactly the same. Psychoanalysis is a technique to cure excessively suffering individuals of the unconsciously misdirected desires and hostilities that weave around them their private webs of unreal terrors. The patient, released from these, finds himself able to participate with comparative satisfaction in the more realistic fears, hostilities, erotic and religious practices, business enterprises, wars, pastimes, and household tasks offered to him by his particular culture. But for the one who has deliberately undertaken the difficult and dangerous journey beyond the village compound, these interests, too, are to be regarded as based on error. Therefore, the aim of the religious teaching is not to cure the individual back again to the general delusion, but to detach him from delusion altogether. Not by readjusting the desire and hostility, for that would only originate a new context of delusion, but by extinguishing the impulses to the very root, according to the celebrated Buddhist Eightfold Path. Right belief, right intentions, right speech, right actions, right livelihood, right endeavoring, right mindfulness, right concentration. The Bodhisattva, however, does not abandon life. Turning his regard from the inner sphere of thought-transcending truth, which can be described only as emptiness, outward again to the phenomenal world, he perceives without the same ocean of being that he found within. From the Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra we read, "Form is emptiness, emptiness form. Emptiness is not different from form. Form is not different from emptiness. What is form is emptiness, what is emptiness form, and the same applies to perception, name, conception, and knowledge. Having surpassed the delusions of his formerly self-assertive, self-defensive, self-concerned ego, he knows without and within the same repose. What he beholds without is the visual aspect of the emptiness on which his own experiences of ego, perceptions, and knowledge ride. And he is filled with compassion for the self-terrorized beings who live in fright of their own nightmare. He rises, returns to them, and dwells with them as an egoless center through whom the principle of emptiness is made manifest in its own simplicity. And this is his great compassionate act, for by it the truth is revealed that in the understanding of one in whom the threefold fire of desire, hostility, and delusion is dead, this world is nirvana. Gift waves go out from such a one for the liberation of all. And so it may be said that the modern therapeutic goal of the cure back to life is attained through the ancient religious discipline. Those who know not only that the everlasting lives in them, but that what they and all things really are is the everlasting, dwell in the groves of the wish-fulfilling trees, drink the brew of immortality, and listen everywhere to the unheard music of eternal concord. These are the immortals. The ultimate boon.
There is a fourth motif, which is that of many of the most popular and vivid myths. It is that of the fire or bride theft. Prometheus stealing the fire from the guardians, male or female. This represents a kind of violence. You have come with the purpose of achieving one aspect of the total goal. You grab it, and not having appeased all the forces on the way down, you become assailed then by those unpropitiated powers. And there is then necessary a flight. This is the way of quest. That's the first half of the story.
When the prince of the lonesome island had remained 6 nights and days on the golden couch with the sleeping queen of Tubbertinte, the couch resting on wheels of gold and the wheels turning continually, the couch going round and round, never stopping night or day, on the 7th morning he said, "It is time for me now to leave this place." So he came down and filled the 3 bottles with water from the flaming well. In the golden chamber was a table of gold, and on the table a leg of mutton with a loaf of bread. And if all the men of Erin were to eat for a 12th month from the table, the mutton and the bread would be in the same form after the eating as before. The prince sat down, ate his fill of the loaf and the leg of mutton, and left them as he had found them. Then he rose up, took his 3 bottles, put them in his wallet, and was leaving the chamber when he said to himself, "It would be a shame to go away without leaving something by which the queen may know who was here while she slept." So he wrote a letter saying that the son of the king of Erin and the queen of the lonesome island had spent 6 days and nights in the golden chamber of Tubbertinte, had taken away 3 bottles of water from the flaming well, and had eaten from the table of gold. Putting his letter under the pillow of the queen, he went out, stood in the open window, sprang on the back of the lean and shaggy little horse, and passed the trees and the river unharmed. The ease with which the adventure is here accomplished signifies that the hero is a superior man, a born king. Such ease distinguishes numerous fairy tales and all legends of the deeds of incarnate gods. Where the usual hero would face a test, the elect encounters no delaying obstacle and makes no mistake. The well is the world navel, its flaming water the indestructible essence of existence, the bed going round and round being the world axis. The sleeping castle is that ultimate abyss to which the descending consciousness submerges in dream, where the individual life is on the point of dissolving into undifferentiated energy, and it would be death to dissolve, yet death also to lack the fire. The motif, derived from an infantile fantasy of the inexhaustible dish, symbolizes the perpetual, life-giving, form-building powers of the universal source. It is a fairy tale counterpart of the mythological image of the cornucopian banquet of the gods. while the bringing together of the two great symbols of the meeting with the goddess and the fire theft reveals with simplicity and clarity the status of the anthropomorphic powers in the realm of myth. They are not ends in themselves, but guardians, embodiments, or bestowers of the liquor, the milk, the food, the fire, the grace of indestructible life. The gods and goddesses, then, are to be understood as embodiments and custodians of the elixir of imperishable being, but not themselves the ultimate in its primary state. What the hero seeks through his intercourse with them is therefore not finally themselves, but their grace, the power of their sustaining substance. This miraculous energy substance, and this alone, is the imperishable. The names and forms of the deities who everywhere embody, dispense, and represent it come and go. This is the miraculous energy of the thunderbolts of Zeus, Yahweh, and the Supreme Buddha, the fertility of the reign of Viracocha, the virtue announced by the bell rung in the Mass at the consecration, and the light of the ultimate illumination of the saint and sage. Its guardians dare release it only to the duly proven. The Japanese have a proverb, "The gods only laugh when men pray to them for wealth." The boon bestowed on the worshipper is always scaled to his stature and to the nature of his dominant desire. The boon is simply a symbol of life energy, stepped down to the requirements of a certain specific case. The irony, of course, lies in the fact that whereas the hero who has won the favor of the god may beg for the boon of perfect illumination, what he generally seeks are longer years to live, weapons with which to slay his neighbor, or the health of his child. The agony of breaking through personal limitations is the agony of spiritual growth. Art, literature, myth, and cult, philosophy, and ascetic disciplines are instruments to help the individual past his limiting horizons into spheres of ever-expanding realization. As he crosses threshold after threshold, conquering dragon upon dragon, the stature of the divinity that he summons to his highest wish increases until it subsumes the cosmos. Finally, the mind breaks the bounding sphere of the cosmos to a realization transcending all experiences of form, all symbolizations, all divinities, a realization of the ineluctable void. The pagan divinity Odin gave an eye to split the veil of light into the knowledge of this infinite dark, and then underwent for it the passion of a crucifixion. From the poetic Edda, Odin speaks, "I know I hung on that windswept tree, hung there for 9 long nights, with the spear I was wounded, and offered I was to Odin, myself to myself, on the tree that none may ever know whither the roots of it run." The Buddha's victory beneath the bow tree is the classic Oriental example of this deed. With the sword of his mind, he pierced the bubble of the universe, and it shattered to naught. The whole world of natural experience, as well as the continents, heavens, and hells of traditional religious belief, exploded together with their gods and demons. But the miracle of miracles was that though all exploded, all was nevertheless thereby renewed. Indeed, the gods of the redeemed heavens raised their voices in harmonious acclaim of the man hero who had penetrated beyond them to the void that was their life and source. And now we turn to the last stage of the hero's journey, the return, beginning with refusal of the return. When the hero quest has been accomplished through penetration to the source or through the grace of some male or female, human or animal personification, the adventurer still must return with his life-transmuting trophy. The full round requires that the hero shall now begin the labor of bringing the runes of wisdom, the golden fleece, or his sleeping princess back into the kingdom of humanity, where the boon may redound to the renewing of the community, the nation, the planet, or the 10,000 worlds. But the responsibility has been frequently refused. Even the Buddha, after his triumph, doubted whether the message of realization could be communicated, and saints are reported to have passed away while in the supernal ecstasy. Numerous indeed are the heroes fabled to have taken up residence forever in the blessed isle of the unaging goddess of immortal being. A moving tale is told of an ancient Hindu warrior king named Muchukunda. He was born from his father's left side, the father having swallowed by mistake a fertility potion that the Brahmins had prepared for his wife. And in keeping with the promising symbolism of this miracle, the motherless marvel, fruit of the male womb, grew to be such a king among kings that when the gods at one period were suffering defeat in their perpetual contest with the demons, they called upon him for help. He assisted them to a mighty victory, and they, in their divine pleasure, granted him the realization of his highest wish. But what should such a king, himself almost omnipotent, desire? What greatest boon of boons could be conceived of by such a master among men? King Muchukunda was very tired after his battle. All he asked was that he might be granted a sleep without end, and that any person chancing to arouse him should be burned to a crisp by the first glance of his eye. The boon was bestowed. In a cavern chamber, deep within the womb of a mountain, King Muchukunda retired to sleep, and there slumbered through the revolving eons. Individuals, peoples, civilizations, world ages came into being out of the void and dropped back into it again, while the old king, in his state of subconscious bliss, endured. Timeless as the unconscious, that old mountain man, the drinker of deep sleep, lived on and on.